Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to Inside Politics. I'm John King in Washington. Thank you for sharing your day with us. Right now, we release brand new CNN poll numbers showing remarkably close midterm contests in two critical battleground states, Arizona and Nevada. Plus, unfathomable, simply unfathomable horror in Thailand. An attacker uses a gun and a knife to murder at least 24 children while they sleep. And another new claim against Herschel Walker, the woman who told the Daily Beast Walker paid her to have an abortion, now says she is also the mother of one of Walker's children. The Georgia Republican Senate nominee says it's a lie, a smear.
I'll say the same thing I said, that I know this is untrue. I know it's untrue, and they keep telling me things like that, and it's totally, totally untrue. I know nothing about any woman having an abortion, and so they can keep coming at me like that. And they're doing it because they want to distract people. I know that.
Back to that story in a moment, but we begin the hour with new numbers, remarkable new numbers that speak volumes about how competitive key races are with just a little more than a month to go in this incredibly consequential midterm campaign. Arizona and Nevada both have Democratic senators fighting for re-election. Both battleground Western states also have big races for governor and for secretary of state. To call them close, all of them, is an understatement. Let's walk through the numbers. Let's start with the Arizona Senate campaign. Mark Kelly is the Democratic incumbent. This is the biggest lead you're going to see as we walk through these polls. He's at 51%. The Republican Blake Masters at 45%, just outside the margin of error. So you can say Mark Kelly is ahead, but it's very narrow and very competitive. He's a Democratic incumbent. Remember that. The governor's race in Arizona, no incumbent here, but the Democrat Katie Hobbs running against the Republican Carrie Lake. Carrie Lake at 46%, Katie Hobbs at 49%, the Democrat. Call that a lead if you will, but there's no clear leader here because that is a statistical tie within the poll's margin of error, remarkably close in the race for Arizona governor. Similarly, when we move over to Nevada, look at the margins. Catherine Cortez Masto is the Democratic incumbent here again, just like the Arizona race. This is critical. It's a 50-50 Senate. The Democratic incumbents need to hang on. But she trails 48% to 46%. If you look at the raw numbers among likely voters in Nevada, that's no clear leader. Again, within the poll's margin of error, a statistical tie in this Nevada Senate race. And the Nevada governor's race, the Democratic incumbent there, Steve Sisolak, the numbers are exactly the same. 48% for the Republican, 46% for the Democratic incumbent in Nevada. Sheriff Joe Lombardo is the Republican candidate. Again, he's ahead 48-46. Statistically, that's a dead heat, another dead heat in the Nevada governor's race. So what is driving this midterm climate? Well, in a midterm campaign, a president's first midterm campaign, his approval rating is generally the North Star, and President Biden is underwater in both of these states. 41% in Arizona, 41% in Nevada approve of Joe Biden's performance. But look, nearly 6 in 10 likely voters in each of these states disapproves of the president's performance. Another warning sign for Democrats as we get into the final month, just look at this. What is the top issue among likely voters, those likely to turn out 33 days from now? Look at this. The economy and inflation, overwhelmingly, 39% of Arizona voters say it's number one. 44% of voters in Nevada say the economy and inflation number one, dwarfing abortion or voting rights, dwarfing abortion and voting rights, perhaps issues that would play in the Democrats' favors. This is a troubling sign for Democrats heading into the final month. Let's get some perspective now with me to share their reporting and their insights. NPR's Claudia Grisales, Sungmin Kim of the Associated Press, Solon Kano Youngs of the New York Times, and our CNN political director, David Chalian. David, remarkably close races, but if you look into the bones, troubling signs for Democrats.
There's no doubt about it, John. And just where you ended there, I think, is critical. That overwhelming sense that the economy and inflation is the dominant issue. This is what jumps out to me at this poll. All the other issues are just not even in the same ballpark in terms of importance to voters. But when you couple that with the overall perception that voters just think the economy, clear majorities in these states, think the economy is getting worse in their states. You noted Joe Biden being underwater. This is why, especially in Nevada, why Republicans see real opportunity there. You went through the Senate and the governor's race there showing how close those contests are and why Republicans see real opportunity. They're also like critical House contests in Nevada.
Right.
So Republicans have sort of set their sights on that state. And you see why they have some sense of hope there that that may be a state that they turn around to their favor, given this environment.
Right. And again, I just want to dig deeper and I'm going to start right here. I mean, just you're 33 days out now. Economy and inflation by far. You look at the abortion issue, you look at the voting rights issues, election integrity issues, critical races when it comes to governor, secretary of state. We'll dig deeper into those races. But that's a gap that favors the Republicans without a doubt. And to David's point, if you look at it more closely here, Claudia, are things getting better or are things getting worse? Only 6% of likely voters in Arizona say things are getting better. Only 15% in Nevada say things are getting better. You have 63% in Arizona, nearly 6 in 10 in Nevada, saying things are getting worse. That, if you just took the names out, forget who's on the ballot, that's a change election right there. That is a recipe of voters who are anxious. When voters are anxious, they want change.
Right, exactly. And we're getting closer and closer to Election Day. And yeah, that anxiety is peaking, as we're seeing, in terms of these numbers. And that's not good news for Democrats who are facing a lot of drags heading into Election Day. And so this is going to be a big worry for them, especially in these nail-biter races that we're looking at.
Let me be a little contrarian. If you just read the bones, Biden's approval rating, views on the economy, you would think the Democrats are getting blown out. Mm-hmm. That they are competitive tells you something. I don't know what it is, but it tells you something.
Right. And this is, I mean, Democrats this summer would have pointed to the Roe decision and the effort to galvanize a wide coalition of voters, younger voters as well, off that decision in the changing momentum. They would have pointed as well to falling gas prices in some states as well when it came to that changing momentum. But these numbers cut against that enthusiasm that we saw this summer from Democrats and the White House. It does show just how overpowering issues like the economy and inflation, also issues that, to be quite honest, the White House does have little tools that they can actually use to address something like inflation as well. While that may be true, voters tend to place blame on the person who's in power at the time. That's just the reality.
What I thought was so interesting in the poll, too, is talking about the motivation and enthusiasm of voters in those two states, because the narrative for several weeks, months since the Dobbs decision has been Democrats are the enthusiastic, motivated party. But in these polls in Arizona and Nevada, it's Republicans who have the double digit enthusiasm leap over the Democrats. And that is certainly fueled by economy and the inflation issues.
And you make perhaps the most salient point in the sense that right after the Dobbs decision in July and August, there's no doubt the external energy, the external enthusiasm favored the Democrats. It looks like it's clearly evident in this poll that that has shifted. We've seen it in some other states as well. If you look at registered voters, Democrats do better. When you then look at likely voters, Republicans do better on every question, on every horse race question, on every issue question. When you go from registered to likely, because, David, they have more enthusiasm.
Exactly. That is the enthusiasm factor playing out that we see. Now, if you look at the people who just say abortion is their most important issue, you see that Democratic enthusiasm around that issue. There just aren't enough of them right now to have them upend the whole sort of environment that these races are taking place. And you said, John, well, why is it then that Dems aren't sort of blowing this out of the water if all this energy, or that Republicans aren't? The reason, John, is that if you look at the favorabilities of these candidates, this gets to Mitch McConnell's point about candidate quality. Blake Masters in our poll, his unfavorables are much higher than Mark Kelly's unfavorables. So that's what gives Kelly that slight edge. Why is Catherine Cortez Masto, perhaps the most vulnerable incumbent Democrat in the country, why is she still in this race? Well, because Adam Laxalt's favorables are not sort of sky high. He also has higher unfavorables, not quite as dramatic as in Arizona. I think that is what's keeping Democrats alive in these contests that otherwise the economy would just wipe them away.
Right. And they have the resources as well. It tells you when the races are so competitive, 33 days out, resources matter. Debates will matter if these candidates are on the debate stage. But again, if you look at the underlying direction, you make a key point about what has changed from right after the Dobbs decision. Are you better off or worse off if the Republicans? If the question is, if Republicans win control of the Congress in Arizona and in Nevada, by a decent margin. That just disappeared on me there. That's what happens with technology every now and then. There you go, right there. In both Arizona and Nevada, voters, by a decent margin, by 11 points in Nevada, by 7 points in Arizona, think they would be better off if Republicans ran the Congress. Again, that's a change dynamic that the Democrats somehow have to try to grab and bend in 30 days.
Right. It's interesting how Democrats were able to squeeze through the Inflation Reduction Act. This was a big win for Democrats, but that's faded quickly. What they're seeing more often on a daily basis is how much is my gas costing today, more than it did a few days ago, a few months ago, what have you, and how much more am I paying for my groceries? That is the daily reminder. Well, big legislation like that takes time to make its way.
That's the key also. A lot of the legislation, while Democrats were celebrating the bills that were passed this summer, whether it's infrastructure from last year or Inflation Reduction Act this year, it takes time. And in the meantime, voters, including in these two pivotal states, are feeling the immediate impacts of these issues. Just one thing, too, on Nevada especially, I do think it also sort of calls to question this thing that Democrats have come to rely on for quite a while, this assumption that you could rely on a transient base of changing demographics in the state. Look, the economy and inflation are also very much resonating with working class voters as well as Latino voters in that state. Our colleagues as well followed grassroots campaigns as they were going around and talking to those voters.
And two more quick points on Nevada. First of all, Nevada has the second highest gas prices in the nation, second only to California. It has been consistently the case. And also, Nevada is the one Senate race where there wasn't this big family feud in the Republican Party over the nominee. And I don't think it's a coincidence that that is where Republicans feel the most optimistic about their chances.
I want to get one more point in, which is these races are critical to the midterm climate. These are also two of the battleground states that are going to be very important in the next presidential election. And I want to show you the two Secretary of State races. This is Arizona. Adrian Fontes is the Democrat. Mark Fincham is the Republican. The Republican is leading. Again, no clear leader there. That's within the statistically, that's a tie. But you see the Republican on top, 49-45. Let's move to Nevada. Cisco Aguilar against Jim Marchant, 46-43. Again, a statistical tie. Both of those Republican candidates, Marchant and Fincham, or election deniers. Marchant has said he would not have certified the Nevada results for Joe Biden if he were the Secretary of State 4 years ago. Fincham has said Joe Biden lost Arizona. Neither of those things. Joe Biden won them both. That is a giant. Voters have a big decision to make here about election integrity, about who you want counting the ballots in your state. And their states just happen to be giant when it comes to presidents.
Yeah. And if the results on election night are like those numbers in the poll, you're going to have these two election deniers overseeing the election process in these battleground states. We asked folks about sort of how they think their vote will be handled and stuff. And you see there's more concern among Republicans that somehow it won't be a fair count, let's say, than you see that among Democrats or independents. So that obviously their election denialism has traction inside the Republican Party.
It's in the bloodstream. Yeah. It's in the bloodstream of the Republican Party. More to discuss about these polling in the days ahead. But next for us, a new twist in another big marquee midterm contest. New accusations against the Republican Senate candidate Herschel Walker and a new denial. Herschel Walker this morning denying another blockbuster new claim that he also has a child with the woman who says Walker paid her to have an abortion back in 2009. That unnamed accuser now telling the Daily Beast this. Maybe there are just so many of us that he truly doesn't remember. But then again, if he really forgot about it, that says something, too. Again, that the anonymous accuser to the Daily Beast. Earlier today, speaking to Hugh Hewitt on the radio, Walker making his most complete and most substantive response to both accusations.
Well, I've already been forgiven. And if I've been forgiven, why in the world would I not be forgiven of something like that? If that had happened, I would have said it because there's nothing to be ashamed of there. You know, people have done that, but I know nothing about it. And if I knew about it, I would be honest and talk about it. But I know nothing about that.
CNN's Eva McCann joins our conversation, essentially saying there that if it had happened, he had been forgiven, meaning between him and God, and he would just say it happened, and he says it didn't.
Yeah, this is, I think we're going to continue to hear this. It's going to be more of the same in the coming days. He's leaning heavily on his faith in rebutting this. He also said, no one has ever told me, sometimes it's hard to understand what he's saying during this interview, but he said, no one has ever told me on I paid for an abortion. So it seems to me that he's leaving an opening to say, well, if I gave this woman money, I didn't know that she was going to go on to use it for an abortion. He also characterized all of this as a distraction. you know, in an ordinary political environment, John, I think this drip, drip, drip of information would be devastating. But we are not in ordinary political times, and we are seeing the full weight of the Republican establishment still rally against him, for him, as we learn more.
There's one exception, and let's just be clear. Jeff Duncan is the lieutenant governor of Florida. He's an anti-Trumper. He believes the Republican Party needs to abandon Trump and abandon people like Herschel Walker. But listen to Jeff Duncan here. He knows the state well. He was elected statewide, of course. He says there are some Republicans who are rattled.
Even the most staunch Republicans, I think, are rattled at the continued flow of information. The weight of that baggage is starting to feel a little closer to unbearable at this point. Herschel Walker won the primary because he scored a bunch of touchdowns back in the 80s, and he was Donald Trump's friend. And now we've moved forward several months on the calendar, and that's no longer a recipe to win.
The question is Lieutenant Governor Duncan right? Because Eva's exactly right that we do not live in normal times.
Right.
When the Access Hollywood tapes came out, everybody said Donald Trump is done. Donald Trump went on to serve as president of the United States. That's one of the things that people in Georgia are saying. People close to Walker are saying that just deny this, keep your head down, plow forward. It's a good environment for Republicans. We'll be okay. But to Lieutenant Governor Duncan's point, it doesn't take much. In a competitive race, if a small percentage of people in the suburbs who maybe were going to vote for Walker, even if they disagree with him, he says he's anti-abortion, say, I can't do it. Or if a small percentage of Christian conservatives say, I can't do it, and they just don't vote. They don't have to vote for the Democrat. They just don't vote. It doesn't take much.
It really doesn't take much. And I don't think those two are contradictory in terms of whether this impacts the race at the end of the day and whether Republicans are rattled. Republicans are certainly rattled, especially the ones I've talked to. They are wondering, what else are we going to hear? We still have more than 4 weeks out from Election Day. But I think some of the calculations that Republicans have made, particularly in standing by Herschel Walker, is one that you mentioned, that when there are allegations, you deny them. It is too late, clearly, to replace them on the ballot, stick by your candidate, or else get punished by your base voters. But also that if you were going to be a voter who was going to vote on this issue, on abortion, maybe issues of character, maybe you weren't going to be a Herschel Walker voter anyway, so maybe it doesn't hurt at the end of the day. But it is we are all, you know, obviously watching what else we're going to see from this race.
It's not the first time that a family dispute has come up, but this is more than a family dispute. I mean, you also have a candidate whose son has gone on publicly to not just undercut this image of a family man who has these family values, but also alleging also abuse as well towards him and his mother. And remember, Herschel Walker's son, Christian Walker, being also a conservative as well in the party, too, and alleging that hypocrisy. So it is, I think we can all say this is more extraordinary than other disputes that have come about in the past here, especially when it comes to allegations undermining the image you're putting forward as a candidate.
And the hypocrisy is an interesting question in the sense that, you know, we do live in these incredibly volatile times. And anyone who tells you they know how something's going to play out, I would have some pause. We'll just watch and see what the voters do. But you have the 23-year-old son, his own son, says, and he says that we told him at the beginning of the campaign, be upfront about all this stuff and deal with it. And he refused to do so. That's what the son says. Now you have this woman who says, number one, he paid her to have an abortion back in 2009. Number two, she says he also is the father of her child. She says he didn't accept responsibility for the kid we did have together. And now he isn't accepting responsibility for the one that we didn't have. That says so much about how he views the role of women in childbirth versus his own. And now he wants to take that choice away from other women and couples entirely. The last part they're getting to, Herschel Walker's position in the campaign is that he is anti-abortion, no exceptions, not for rape, not for incest, not for life of mother. The question is, when you take that public position and then you have an accusation like this, which he denies, does it convince enough voters, you know, it's hypocrisy or just enough of a character cloud that I can't do this?
Yeah, that's going to be the big test for Georgia, is what does this do in the end with these new developments? And again, we have to see what could be coming next, and having this very vocal comments from his son, very powerful, heartbreaking comments from him, talking about that he's hearing we're going to lose Georgia from conservatives and other concerns, and saying don't lie, don't lie. I mean, those are really striking messages. So it remains to be seen in this state whether it's going to make a difference, however, because it is unusual times and it's hard to say.
What we've seen, though, from Republican voters is a level of discipline, at least in the recent past, in which they have tunnel vision and are really laser focused on getting their policy priorities over the finish line. And if that means supporting an unsavory candidate, you know, so be it. They're more concerned about how Herschel Walker would vote in the Senate on abortion than maybe the past actions he engaged in, the alleged actions.
And the initial reaction of the money was we are going to continue to support Herschel Walker. Both a super PAC close to Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, other outside the National Republican Senatorial Committee, says the money's going. Here's my question, though. We just went through the tight race in Arizona. We just went through the tight race in Nevada. There are tight Senate races in Pennsylvania, in Wisconsin, in North Carolina. How long do Republicans take to look at the data to see is there a bleeding of support away from Herschel Walker? And if so, resources are finite. Do you take that money and move it somewhere else? So today, they're all in. When will we answer the question, are they really all in?
I think, I mean, they've already had to go in places where they, I'm sure they wish they wouldn't have had to spend, like in the Ohio Senate race. I think as long as the race stays very close in the margin of error, that McConnell super PAC, other allied Republican organizations will still be invested in it, but we'll have to see the numbers.
I think history shows at this point that in recent history and just from conversations I've had as well, the Republican Party as it stands, the funding, the machine behind it, tend to stick with their candidates even through some of these controversies.
I'll just add this wrinkle as we go. This is about November 8th. But if no candidate in Georgia gets 50% plus one, then the two top candidates have a runoff in December. So this could go on for a month past Election Day, if you will. Up next for us, some brand new CNN reporting on the Republican wish list if they win the House majority in November. It includes a possible impeachment. Yes, it does. We'll tell you who and why next. I'm going to bring you some new CNN reporting now on House Republicans and their post-election priorities. Some lawmakers telling CNN if they win the majority in next month's midterms, they could quickly launch an impeachment effort. Not against President Biden, they say, but instead the cabinet secretary in charge of the southern border. That would be the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. He is, according to this reporting, the GOP's number one target. Our chief congressional correspondent, Mano Raju, joins our conversation. I just want to put up here... Why would you impeach Secretary Mayorkas? Some say he has failed to maintain operational control of the border. Make that argument. Is that impeachable? He's accused of blocking stringent border controls, including Donald Trump's wall. Again, that's a policy difference with House Republicans. How does that a high crime or misdemeanor? Congressman Chip Roy, though, does say he believes Mayorkas lied to him under oath. And you talked to him about this. Let's listen.
Because I believe that he lied to me under oath. I believe that he has been denying the reality of the border purposely. And as a result, Americans have died, migrants have died. But, you know, impeachment cases are things you build. You know, you build and make your case. And I think we ought to have those conversations.
What about Biden? There's been some talk about impeaching Biden. How do you feel about that?
That's a much bigger political question.
Well, let's leave Biden aside for a minute. If you could prove somebody lied to you under oath, okay, let's have the conversation about high crimes and misdemeanors. What does Chip Roy say was a lie?
I mean, there's the way he discussed how the administration has handled the border and their decisions that they've made to deal with the border. And really, it's about maintaining operational control over the border. And the administration defends what they have done at the border. That is not what the view of the House Republicans is. And the debate within the conference right now is, does what the administration has and has not done, has that risen to the bar of high crimes and misdemeanors? This is nothing to take lightly here, John. Huh. Only one time in American history has a cabinet secretary been impeached by the House because of the fact that it is high crime and misdemeanor. And there is serious discussion happening within the Republican conference right now, not just among the right flank, which widely supports this idea, which is also very influential within the conference, but also people who are close to Kevin McCarthy as well. Even and Jim Jordan, who would be in line to chair the House Judiciary Committee, would be in charge of impeachment proceedings, says he supports it, says that McCarthy has indicated to them that he would be open to talking about it. And when my colleague Melina Zanona asked McCarthy directly, would you go forward with impeachment proceedings? He says, quote, what happens at the border is above everything else. He would not go that far, but still, a lot of Republicans are still leery about this idea.
Well the leery part is interesting in the sense that if they take the majority, you can make a case for aggressive oversight. And I would listen to Republicans if they wanted to say Democrats have not had enough oversight of the situation at the border or some other thing. That's a conversation and a debate I think that would be worth having. The question is, do you impeach somebody? Do you accuse somebody of high crimes and misdemeanors, or do you just have aggressive oversight and ask the policy questions? This, you mentioned some people. Jim Jordan, Mayorkas deserves it. It will be a conference decision. Congresswoman Lauren Boebert, Mayorkas should be a priority. Steve Womack, though, Republican, says we should focus on policy. And Tom Cole, a veteran Republican, says I don't think it would be a very wise decision. However, at the moment, Tom Cole, who might have this experience, does not have as much juice, shall we say, with the leadership as a Jim Jordan.
Right, right. And I think all the talk that we have about Democrats having had momentum over the last, you know, last several weeks and perhaps cutting their losses in the House, it won't matter at the end of the day when Kevin McCarthy's the speaker, Republicans have the chairmanships and they have subpoena power and gavels. And if they have a majority of the House, could pursue impeachment proceedings. But I think the Tom Cole perspective is interesting because I think that there are some Republicans, not I don't know how many, but there are still some Republicans that are concerned about overreach. You know, Republicans felt that Democrats overreached in pursuing the first impeachment of Donald Trump in particular. And so I think there are many people in Washington who are very cognizant of that political calculation.
And so how does this work out in the sense that if you're Kevin McCarthy and you have a huge majority or big majority, maybe you listen more to everybody. If you have a tiny majority, is the message from voters don't go too far, or is the message going to end up being that means Marjorie Taylor Greene, Laura Boebert, Jim Jordan have more influence over you because there aren't quote unquote moderates around to say, whoa, slow down.
Exactly. If they do have this thin majority as been projected in some cases, how do you wrangle everybody together with this thin majority to go after an impeachment, say, of Biden? Maybe that's too tall an order. Mayorkas, maybe we can get everybody on board. We have a bigger chance going there first. Maybe it's the warm-up act before they look at bigger folks like Biden himself. So it is really tricky when you have these extreme corners of the party and it's a thin majority. You have a lot to balance as speaker in that situation.
And we've already heard at the White House and at the Department of Homeland Security beefing up the legal staffs to figure this out, right? They expect this coming.
Oh, there's been an awareness that this could be coming. I mean, for some time now, Republicans have also been clear about it. Not only beefing up the legal staff, but also a certain anxiety about how much time and resources will need to be dedicated to going back and forth on the Hill when you still do have a very real issue at the border as well. It's fascinating. If you listen to a lot of the members of Congress that are pushing for this, you would hear that, you know, not enough has been done at the border. You hear questions about Biden's decisions there. The fascinating thing about this issue is the White House is facing pressure also from Democrats on side and a progressive flank for actually prolonging the time that Trump-era policies were at the border. That had to do as well with court decisions. So definitely an issue that's not going away or a concern going away.
Quickly as we go, how much of this is we think there's grounds for impeachment? How much of this is the Democrats impeached Donald Trump twice?
That's what one of the concerns is. Steve Womack told me this is revenge-type politics that could actually hurt the country. But it will depend on the speakership, potentially, if McCarthy needs the votes of those people who are pushing it. Will he make those promises to assure them that he will go down this route? And also, will Mayorkas stay on? If he resigns, it could be a moot issue. But his office tells us he has no plans to resign.
Remarkable reporting. We watch 33 days to the election, and then we go from there. Important word just into us now. The January 6th committee will hold a likely final hearing. The committee advising it will convene next Thursday, October 13th at 1 p.m. Eastern for what it says will be the final evidentiary hearing. Up next, new details on a simply numbing tragedy. More than 30 dead, including at least 24 young children. That after a massacre at a child care center in Thailand. To a just incredibly sad global story now, at least 36 people are dead, including 24 children and a pregnant woman. That after a rampage at a nursery in Thailand. Police say the killer is a former police officer. They say he attacked a daycare center with a gun and a knife while the children were sleeping. Officials say the suspect also killed himself, his wife, and his child. CNN's Selena Wang is tracking this story for us. Selena, it is horrific and it is numbing. What else do we know?
John, well, we are learning from authorities new details about this horrifying tragedy. This is believed to be the deadliest rampage in Thailand's history. Authorities had originally called this massacre a mass shooting, but now we're learning that many of the people died from knife-stabbing wounds. Authorities say that this 34-year-old man went to the nursery around noontime looking for his 2-year-old stepson. He could not find him. He managed to enter a room where 24 kids were sleeping during their lunchtime nap time. He began shooting and stabbing the children and the staff members there. The police say all but one child died in that room. Authorities say that the man then left by his car to drive home, in the process running and ramming into bystanders. When he got home, he killed his stepson and his wife, and then he took his own life. Now, when it comes to motives, the police say they are not ruling anything out, including hallucination from drugs, personal stress. They are going to get a blood test. Now, this man does have a history of drug use, according to the authorities. And in fact, he was in court for drug-related charges just hours before he went on this shooting rampage. He is a former police officer who had been dismissed from the police force on these drug charges. This is an absolutely horrifying, profoundly shocking moment for Thailand. This is a country where, yes, the rates of gun ownership are relatively high compared to other countries in the region. However, mass shootings are rare in Thailand. And important to note, John, that where the shooting happened in northeastern Thailand, this is a peaceful, tranquil place that is not known to be violent. This is a nation now that is in grief and shock and horror. John?
Beyond horrific. Selena Wang, grateful for the important update there on an incredibly sad story. To another big global story now, a ballistic missile barrage from North Korea. American warships now sending a signal back to Pyongyang. Japan and South Korea also on edge because of this. CNN's Oren Lieberman is live at the Pentagon for us. Oren, there are those who say Kim Jong-un sometimes just wants attention. But if you look at the reaction from the Japanese and the South Korean government and now the American military, they seem to think there's something bigger at play here.
Well, this is much more than just attention at this point. According to a CNN count, over the course of the past 2 weeks, the North Koreans have launched ballistic missiles on six separate occasions. A total of 10 missiles launched there. Most of them have been short-range ballistic missiles, but one of those was an intermediate-range ballistic missile just a few days ago that overflew Japan for the first time in about 5 years. The U.S. clearly responding here along with South Korea and Japan, emphasizing its partnerships and its alliances in the region with a show of force and a message that the U.S. will not be deterred here. The latest exercise, a naval missile defense exercise with the South Koreans and the Japanese. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said the point of the exercise and this work, this operation, is to improve the ability to intercept and track future North Korean ballistic missile launches if it comes to that. But that's just the latest. There have been aerial exercises, test fires of ATACMs. Those are long-range, precision-guided surface-to-surface munitions, as well as an anti-submarine exercise conducted last week. And that underscores how seriously the U.S. is taking this. Worth noting that that anti-submarine exercise was the first in several years. According to South Korea, the U.S. showing its willingness to engage with its allies in the region, that it will not be deterred by North Korea's ongoing ballistic missile launches, 24 by a CNN count since the beginning of the year, and Kim Jong-un clearly showing that he wants this to continue. Secretary of State Antony Blinken saying in Chile that if North Korea continues on this path, it's more condemnation and more isolation.
Those numbers quite remarkable. Oren Lieberman, grateful you're keeping track of it for us. Tense moment there. Oren, thank you. Up next for us, President Biden today calling a big decision to cut oil production a, quote, disappointment. What it could mean for you the next time you fill up and what it might mean in the election. That's next. President Biden today voicing his disappointment at the OPEC Plus decision to slash oil production by 2 million barrels a day. But the president defending his trip to Saudi Arabia this summer, saying the primary focus was not oil.
There's a lot of alternatives. The trip was not essentially for oil. The trip was about the Middle East and about Israel and rationalization of positions. But it is a disappointment, and it says that there are problems.
Our great reporter's back with us. It says they're a problem. The president there, it's the Saudis, it's others, the Russians as well, involved in OPEC Plus. He also says there are a lot of alternatives. The administration now has to worry anyway, but especially a month away from a midterm election, gas prices are starting to trickle back up. What alternatives? What can he do?
Well, we've seen the administration before go to strategic barrel reserve for one, you know, to try and lower this impact, try and diminish this impact of high gas prices on consumers. But let's be honest, this was something the administration was relying on. And it was a bet on the president's influence over some of these, the Gulf region and Arab allies. And now you're seeing the frustration when that bet is not adding up here. It's worth noting that it shouldn't have actually been a surprise that OPEC would also act in its own interest here, and that maybe the sway, the pitch of trying to combat the impact of Russia's invasion in Ukraine would not sell that much. Let's remember, Iran is a member. Iran has recently sold drones to Russia. Also, you have one of Russia's deputy ministers as well was involved in this meeting and the decision-making process here, and now you're seeing the result.
Right. And it's complicated. No president of the United States, Democrat or Republican, can snap his fingers and affect the price of oil. It's a global market. You have these other regimes that may have grievances against him or against the United States more generally. But the optics are when he traveled to Saudi Arabia, he had that fist bump with the crown prince right there, who is a murderer. And the president said, I had to do other stuff there. Republicans see this as T-ball. This is just in the last hour. Biden's energy policies have purposely crippled American energy production. Biden is begging Saudi Arabia and Venezuela for oil. Preposterous, humiliating. This is what America last looks like. These dictators ignored Biden's pleas, slashed supply, and sent energy prices soaring. Again, it's more complicated, but sometimes politics comes down, gas prices are, we can show you the graphic, trickling back up a little bit. Bad trend for the president.
Bad trend for the president after a really great trend for the White House. And, the White House was very eager to take credit for gas prices when they were going down by nearly 100 days straight. So, of course, Republicans are going to seize on that and blame the White House when they are trending back upward. You know, we spent some time talking about, Herschel Walker's troubles and kind of that October issue. I think the October surprise for Democrats may be the rising gas prices. And because that is, I mean, we talk about this all the time. Gas prices are some of the most visual, consumer goods out there. You see the price every day as you drive up and down the roads. Really hard for consumers to ignore that.
And so the man who would be Speaker, Republican Kevin McCarthy on Fox today says, elect us, things will change.
One of our first lines of work is to make America energy independent. And that means you'll pay less at the pump. America should wake up, because in 33 days, we need you to join with us. They knew their policies would bring it this direction.
America needs to know, just to fact check there, just like Joe Biden can't do this, neither could a Speaker McCarthy. That would just be the House of Representatives, no matter what their positions, whether you agree or disagree with them at home, you'd have to get the Senate and the president to go along. Unlikely.
Right, exactly. But Republicans are in this advantageous position where they can sell this message of, look what Democrats are doing to your gasoline prices. We can turn it around, even if that's not based in reality.
Up next for us, a remarkable moment while the president was in Florida yesterday, caught on a hot mic, dropping the F-bomb. Topping our political radar today, President Biden caught on a hot mic during his trip to Florida to see the damage from Hurricane Ian. He's talking here to the mayor of Fort Myers Beach.
Thanks for coming down. We appreciate it. I kicked the finger.
You raised some.
Someday we'll learn the context of that. The president also making an effort on that trip to put politics aside, standing with the Republican governor Ron DeSantis, even calling the governor's response to the hurricane, quote, pretty remarkable. Governor DeSantis also, too, praising his cooperation with the White House and with FEMA. The Secret Service acknowledging a minor car accident that involved the vice president was not properly reported up the chain of command at first. The vehicle carrying Vice President Harris from her home to the White House hit a curb. The Secret Service, though, initially attributed that accident to mechanical failure. That was updated later with the account that the driver hit a curb. No one was hurt. The vice president finished her commute in another vehicle. But the Washington Post reporting, the new Secret Service chief is concerned the incident was not properly reported from the get-go. Clemency requests, healthcare documents, IRS forms, election paperwork. Those, some of the items the FBI recovered when it served its search warrant at Mar-a-Lago. That, according to a Justice Department list made public this week. The collection even included Trump's resignation letter from the Screen Actors Guild. A special master is reviewing that trove of documents, even as the Justice Department challenges that process. Worth remembering, more than 100 classified documents found and recovered at the Trump's estate, now in the hands of the Justice Department. Thanks for your time today on Inside Politics. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Ana Cabrera picks up our coverage right now.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.